Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with landscape architect Kim Wilkie. He's the designer of Longwood Gardens' new East Conservatory Plaza. Susan Lewis considers artists' self-portraits and artistic identity with a visit to an exhibition at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. We speak with Robert Whitman. He writes of his years as head of the FBI's Art Crime Unit in Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. And David Patrick Stearns explores the growing international reputation of Baltic composers. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Visitors to Longwood Gardens now have access to a new outdoor plaza that serves as both a venue for lectures and events, as well as a place for visitors to sit and relax. Similar to an amphitheater, the Eastern Conservatory Plaza is an entirely grass-covered, curved landform seamlessly integrated into the landscape. The real gem of this new plaza, however, lies beneath the surface. Hidden within the new form is a restroom complex which is surrounded by the largest living or green wall in North America. The wall itself is made of organic panels in which plants like orchids and holly ferns grow horizontally. All of it is the creation of UK-based landscape architect Kim Wilkie. Wilkie had an intense introduction to his chosen profession. The son of a British military attaché, read secret agent, he grew up in the Malaysian jungle and the deserts of Iraq before being sent to school in England. He studied history at Oxford and environmental design at Berkeley before founding his own landscape studio in London in 1989. Since then, his practice has forged a reputation for bold new designs in complex settings. Among his high-profile designs are the gardens at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, a restoration and management plan for New York University, as well as projects at World Heritage Sites in Transylvania and the Russian Arctic Circle. I spoke with Kim Wilkie at Longwood Gardens and first asked him to describe his work there.
Longwood have created a whole new entrance plaza to their conservatory complex, and the challenge was to make something that blended with the landscape and the landforms and welcomed visitors in both from the entrance and the visitor centre and directed them from the conservatory down into the gardens. So what we've ended up with is a very sinuous, curving sculptural landform which works with the trees and the forest behind and has a south-facing cupped curve that directs people down to the rest of the gardens. And also from the very top you can see the fountain garden and the topiary garden. So it's a nice high vantage point that looks back to the conservatory and the rest.
How quickly did the form suggest itself to you when you first approached the project?
Surprisingly quickly, because there's not a lot of space at the end of the conservatory there. It dips down into the old Doe Run, which was the road through Longwood. And in a short space, you have to deal with a very large and significant building and then curve it south very quickly. And at the same time, we also had to fit in a new building, a restroom complex. So we tucked that under the landform. So you get this very curving, sinuous landform with a curving, sinuous restroom underneath.
And as you enter the restrooms, you come across perhaps the masterpiece of the entire project, what will be the longest green wall in the United States. I think a lot of people are familiar with green roofs, maybe not so much green walls. What are they and what purpose does it serve in this context?
The idea was to tuck the whole complex underneath the landform, but to make it top lit so the light comes in from up above. And because it's coming from a conservatory and Longwood have all the expertise of horticulture, the idea was then to clad the walls in orchids and ferns and green plants so that they're growing out of the walls. And you have this huge, long, continuous green serpentine jungle. And then you step through the jungle into each little restroom pod.
But to be very clear, these are not creeping plants or...
No, they're actually sitting in soil that's attached to the wall.
When did you first develop an expertise, because I gather you have some significant expertise in this area?
Strangely enough, I grew up in Malaysia, where orchids and ferns grow out of tree trunks and out of vertical faces. So it's something that I've always had a fascination with. And it's a way of turning what can be a rather humdrum functional space into something much more exciting.
much of your work is done in the UK. You're coming to different climate, different growing conditions, and this green wall is also inside. Tell us about some of the challenges about plant selection and what was going to go into this wall.
In some ways, it being inside is an advantage because it's like an extension of the conservatories. The climate is controlled, and Longwood have fantastic expertise in plants. So it is a mixture of plants that like to grow in vertical crevices with extra cover to make sure it's completely green. But it's really been drawing on Longwood's star expertise in this area.
A shame the only time people are going to get to see it, though, is when they go to the bathroom.
They do that rather a lot.
How would you like visitors to use this space? Because, as you say, it's part entryway, it's part performance space. It's doing a lot of things.
And actually, because it is sinuous and curves up and works with the rest of the landform and the gardens, it's about flowing through it, but also the curves make little eddies off it. So I hope that there'll be times when it's just one person sitting there peacefully in the evening sun, and other times when there are 1,500 people enjoying a piece of music. So it has to be very flexible. It's an entrance, but it's also a place just to rest and be on your own.
Landscape architect Kim Wilkie. His Eastern Conservatory Plaza is now open at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Artists have used self-portraits as training exercises, as ways to promote themselves, and for personal exploration and documentation. From formal headshots to narrative scenes to abstract styles, these works provide a glimpse of how artists see themselves. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers a range of self-portraits, with a visit to Narcissus in the Studio, an exhibition now at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts.
In the first part of the gallery, we come eye to eye with artists, their palettes in hand, brushes ready.
And they're about to either put a stroke on a picture or they're looking intently out at us.
PAFA's curator of modern art, Robert Cozzolino, has organized this exhibition by theme, starting off with works that conjure the illusion that we are part of the moment of creation.
It'll feel like they're all looking at you and making images of you. They're at their easels, and what they're really seeing is a mirror, but you are walking in front of it.
This is only the beginning of the exhibition of over 100 works that range from formal portraits to narrative scenes, from busts to full figures, from realistic to abstract, and pictures without any figures at all. There are even several sculptures. With some exceptions of portraits made of artists by other artists, all are in some way self-portraits, artistic expressions of identity created anywhere from the 1770s to 2010. Self-portraiture is a practice that goes way back.
From Vermeer to Rembrandt, on to Cézanne.
One of the artists in this show is painter Elizabeth Osborne, who has taught at the Academy for more than 40 years.
It's something that so many artists do. Often it's early in their career. Some continue till they die doing a series of self-portraits, which I have done. Although this particular painting does not have me in it, only symbols of me.
Osborne has become known for her use of color. In this work, created in her longtime studio that looked out onto the Ben Franklin Bridge, she represents herself with colorful vertical stripes in a rectangle standing on a table's edge. Alongside it is another rectangle through which we can see the outline of the bridge with which she has a direct family connection.
The view looking outward of the bridge and that little window was a symbol for my father who designed that bridge, Paul Cray.
Another non-conventional portrait is that of 2008 PAFA alum Mia Rosenthal, who has used her art to document a wide variety of subjects, from the contents of cereal boxes to stamps. As for realistic self-portraits, Rosenthal says she's done them as part of her education, but not happily.
I just obsess over, like, blemishes and hair, so it was always completely miserable, and I can't ever see a day that I would try to make a traditional portrait.
Postpartum Portrait is a drawing of all the clothes that still fit Rosenthal 3 months after her son was born, from socks and pajamas on up.
Clothing is part of that identity, how you present yourself to the world, and I felt like a real schlump at the time. It's the stuff that fit was like sweatpants and old shirts, but if you put them in a drawing, it's kind of funny and you can laugh about it, so it was also, I think, a way to mediate that time for myself.
Self-portraits have served various purposes throughout history. During the Renaissance and beyond, artists used them to showcase their talents and demonstrate to potential clients a range of ways in which they could be represented. Robert Cozzolino says that was definitely the case with the great Baroque era master.
Rembrandt made so many self-portraits. Partly it could have been just a way of exploring who he was. We think of that from a modern viewpoint, but it was also a practical thing. And so the range of self-portraits, showing himself in shadow, showing a full-length body, showing him in a different kind of costume, demonstrated what one might get from Rembrandt.
Other artists put themselves in scenes that act as social or political commentary, like the 1937 self-portrait of George Grosz, who fled Germany in the mid-30s during the rise of the Nazis.
It's called Remembering. It shows George Grosz kind of shivering, huddled in the left-hand side of the painting in a bombed-out, ruined building. And it's one of those paintings where Grosz is really ruminating on what, by 1937, is very clearly a regime of terror in Germany.
Grosz based his picture in part on a photograph, and Elizabeth Osborne says the use of photography as a source expanded the kinds of images produced in self-portraits.
You can get expressions of much more dramatic or expressions of things more in motion as a smile or a scream or whatever, even though it takes, I think, a very skilled artist to make that, to translate that to canvas or to sculpture without it looking like a copied photograph.
Facial expressions in self-portraits are often serious, but not always. Robert Cozzolino points to artist Priscilla Roberts' self-portrait, her eyes wide with surprise.
As though she's caught off guard by what she sees in the mirror, it breaks that kind of mold of the simple sort of closed-mouthed, intent look. And it's more active, but it's part of a tradition of using the human face and often using self-portraits to show a kind of taxonomy of emotions.
A range of emotions by a variety of artists throughout time. Every artist from whatever century, whether making a formal self-portrait, a narrative scene, or using symbolism and abstraction, makes choices about what to reveal. Artists grappling with identity, just as anyone has done who's chosen a photograph to give someone or post online. At the end of the exhibition is a window into a cubicle where visitors can watch PAFA students create their own self-portraits, making those choices as to which features they want to put forth when they say, "Here I am."
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Narcissus in the Studio, Artist Portraits and Self-Portraits runs through January 2nd at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. Robert Whitman spent 20 years as an FBI special agent. His early training in music and Eastern art and antiques made him ideally suited to investigating art crimes. Assigned to the Philadelphia Field Division, he was instrumental in solving many high-profile arts and antiquities crimes, including thefts from the Rodin Museum, the Penn Museum, and the Pennsylvania Historical Society. Over the course of his career, Whitman estimates he had a hand in the recovery of more than $225 million worth of stolen art and cultural property, and in the prosecution and conviction of numerous art thieves both in the US and abroad. He details many of these investigations and his own personal struggles in his memoir, Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. I met with Robert Whitman at his home in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Despite the fact that even as a young boy you wanted to be in the FBI, your eventual route there was rather circuitous. The experience you had before going into the Bureau somewhat contributed to you eventually having this interest in solving art crimes.
Right. Well, you know, what had happened was my dad was very much interested in art and antiques. He was in Japan right after the Second World War, during the Korean War, and he met my mother. And my father was collecting antiques at that time in Japan, and he brought many back to the States with him and got involved in the antiques business. And I kind of grew up around that whole setting, you know, with the art and antiques. And as a result, it wasn't so much I learned about antiques as much as I learned about the business of art and antiques. And that's really what is important when you do undercover work, trying to recover these paintings. You know, you can learn the art history, but you can't learn how to do business. I was also a classical music aficionado. I loved piano music. And even in college, when I was in college, my first year in college, I was thinking about being a performance major for piano. And, you know, as a result, I fell in love with all the classics. It kind of went hand in hand.
Tell us some of the standout cases that you investigated.
Some of the interesting pieces, the Bill of Rights the copy that was stolen from North Carolina in 1865, one of only 14 original copies of the Bill of Rights. We recovered that when someone tried to sell that to the National Constitution Center. Another interesting case was a Rembrandt self-portrait valued at about $35 million that had been stolen at gunpoint from the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm. That case took us almost 6 years to solve. In the end, we were able to recover that piece in an undercover operation in Copenhagen, Denmark. There have been many, many interesting cases. Another one was a battle flag, a Civil War battle flag that was carried in a battle by the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique, which was an African-American U.S. Army regiment. And in that battle of Port Hudson, I believe 4 to 5 people were shot out from under the flag. So it was considered to be a blood cloth. You know, what's interesting is that the value of that particular flag was about $30,000 on the open market. Of course, the Rembrandt was valued at $35 million that we spoke about. But, you know, the true value of the two pieces is not the financial, it's not the monetary, it's the cultural history and a cultural value. You know, what's worth more? A regimental battle flag that symbolizes the end of slavery and freedom for, a large segment of our population, or a painting that was done in 1630. Both are very valuable, both are important, but they both have immense cultural value.
You narrate in the book the fact that the gentleman who tried to sell you the flag was one of the dumbest criminals you'd ever come across. Tell us about who were the more clever ones you came across.
You know, I wouldn't say they were clever. I think that the real art and art theft is the selling of the piece, not the stealing. All these individuals were good at stealing, okay? They were good criminals, put it that way. When I say good, I mean they were proficient in their chosen profession. Just for example, the guys who stole the Rembrandt, they went into the Swedish National Museum, they had machine guns, they put everybody on the floor. They had two car bombs go off on the main roads that led to the museum from the mainland. They made their getaway after stealing three paintings. There was two Renoirs and the Rembrandt in a speedboat. So, you know, were they proficient criminals? Yeah, they got away with it. But they got caught in the end because they tried to sell them. And in the end, they sell them to the police. You know, were they good criminals? No, most of them were not proficient. I mean, they were not smart or clever or charming. There's not many Pierce Brosnans out there in the crime world.
The Gardner Museum heist from 1990 is probably one of the greatest unsolved art thefts. Is it something that you still ponder, now retired from the FBI?
Oh, I ponder it, of course. It's my belief and in my opinion that the paintings are in France. I think that we were within maybe 2 weeks of recovering the Vermeer and the Rembrandt. The Vermeer is called the Concert. It's a masterpiece. It's the only Vermeer missing in the world. The Rembrandt was the storm over the Sea of Galilee. It's the only seascape Rembrandt ever did. I worked for almost 2 years in an undercover operation involving Miami, Boston, and Paris. And it's my belief that those paintings are still in Marseille, in the south of France.
In someone's collection?
Not so much in a collection. There are gangs in France that do these types of thefts. It's not the only thing they do. They're also involved in drug running. They're also involved in money laundering and murder. But they also steal art. And they do it for two purposes. One purpose is to try to sell it. If they can't sell it, they save it. And then what they use it for is get out of jail free cards. In other words, they can turn around at that point, negotiate some type of settlement when they get caught for other crimes, and use those paintings as negotiating chips. So, you know, these gangs are known to be doing that. There's a group called the La Brise La Mer in Marseille that are very much involved in these types of heists.
So you expect these paintings will show up at some point?
Yeah, I think the fact that we didn't get them back is, of course, a loss, but really the epic victory in that investigation, in my belief, is to know that they exist. They're not destroyed, you know, they still exist, and that gives you hope of the possibility and probability of recovering them.
Could you steal any painting?
Could I steal a painting? You mean practically, I guess anyone could steal a painting. I would never do that.
With your specialized knowledge, could you walk into a museum and say, yes, I can have any one of these paintings based on my knowledge of how they're secured?
Sure, if I wanted to get caught.
Robert Whitman. His best-selling memoir is Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. The future of classical music, or at least a part of it, is coming from some unlikely places, the Baltic Republics. Beyond the hypnotic sacred music of the Estonian Arvo Pärt, Increasingly fantastical pieces have been appearing on Philadelphia concert programs from Baltic composers with even more unpronounceable names. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns went to the celebrated Nargen Festival in Estonia to see if these Baltic composers are all they seem to be. And in Tallinn, Riga, and even on an island out in the Baltic Sea, he discovered a multitude of dedicated composers.
Could anybody have guessed, in this performance of Velio Tormius' Autumn Landscape by the Temple University Concert Choir, what lay behind this strange, entrancing music? Certainly, I never foresaw traveling to the near-deserted island of Naissaar, a 45-minute ferry ride from the Estonian capital of Tallinn, for a festival celebrating Tormius' 80th birthday. Though fellow Estonian Arvo Pärt is more famous, his brand of holy minimalism, the genre he created, is a musical law unto himself. The key to understanding the sensibility and imagination of so many other Estonian composers was more likely to be heard in Tormius, who is considered a hero as well as an artist. His concerts are held in places laden with larger meaning, an abandoned munitions factory, or a one-time Soviet stronghold on the island of Naissaar. In effect, music takes root on previously scorched earth. On Naissaar, as we ride a motorized cart along the unpaved roads between the boat dock and the concert hall, Estonian musicologist Hervé Lippus explains the presence of diffused landmines, rusty Soviet machinery, and a crumbling Swedish church along the way.
Well, it has history until 1940, because this was inhabited by Estonian Swedes. They were farming and fishing men living here. But as they were Swedes, they got the possibility to flee to Sweden before the Soviets came.
Upon arrival on the highest point of the island, once a lookout point to view approaching ships, I meet the lean, energetic Tormius, nicely recovered from a heart attack but still sneaking cigarettes. Lippus was our interpreter.
Velio is proposing to talk at once?
Sure.
When a young man, Tormius had a bright future in Russia. Dmitri Shostakovich was among his champions when he took a less prestigious left turn, devoting the rest of his life to folk-based choral music. The music was sung, among other places, in massive Estonian song festivals, where the residents of this country of 1.5 million people no longer felt so tiny next to the massive Soviet Union. Slowly, over time, these festivals were such a nationalistic flashpoint that Estonian independence is said to have come out of the singing revolution. Tormius' music was an important part of that, even if he credits other musicians with having greater influence.
In 1969, when Velio wrote the cantata for the General Song Festival, that probably had some effect. He doesn't feel that he helped to bring about the singing revolution. Actually, singing revolution took place in other musical genres. That was more in pop and rock and...
Over the years, however, what passed for folk-based music, in fact, reflected the long-simmering rage against repression. Tormius' music from the 1970s was particularly angry.
That's true, but then there was something against what to be angry. And that lasted into the 80s.
Historically, Estonian painting and music tended to be a Me Too version of art created in more cosmopolitan places. But when the Soviet imposed isolation ended, composers started cherry-picking outside influences and putting them together in their own distinctively rugged fashion. The acclaimed Estonian composer Erkki Sventure lives on an island not unlike Naissaar, but takes his creative cues from the power of nature.
You are in a connection with something which is so much older and bigger than we are here in this planet. And I think it plays a role. It's not that I'm painting the nature with sounds. I'm not at all. But I think that this environment helps me with a great deal to concentrate on my work and to get the energy for it.
More startling are the choral works coming out of the Baltic states. Early in 2010, Donald Nelly's group, The Crossing, sang a piece titled Sundogs from a young Latvian composer that nobody had even begun to hear about. Eriks Esenvalds didn't even have much of a bio except for the fact that he had taught high school. Nelly discovered him almost by chance.
Some person at a concert here, she came to listen to us and she said, "Oh my God, your choir would love this Latvian friend of mine. He writes this new music." And I'm like, "Oh, well, you should give me a CD. I'll listen to it, or give me a score, you know." And the next thing I knew, I had like programmed it for January.
Now 33 and a father of three, Esenvalds quit teaching, now sings with the Latvian State Choir, and is writing a piece for The Crossing to be premiered next year. Though American choirs have, until recently, stayed close to conservative idioms, Esenvalds explained in a noisy cafeteria in Riga that Latvian choirs welcome being pushed to their limits.
We have been encouraged to search new ways in writing for choir. And we have added whispering, breathing, whistling, additional instruments. So I would call that process the choir to become also an orchestra.
Not all Latvian composers are so thoughtful. Lest we unduly idealize them, the Latvian State Choir, on the day I visited, was rehearsing a kitschy pop choral fusion. Leonard Bernstein had been there and done that 35 years ago. But as one composer said, the Baltic Republics did not do it 35 years ago and must get it out of their system somehow. For all their stubborn independence, the Baltic composers are moving towards the classical mainstream. When Esenvalds writes a choral work, it's often in English to enhance his performance prospects. Vocal-only composers are now embracing the orchestra. Arvo Pärt's Symphony No. 4, his first work in that medium for many decades, is out on the ECM label. Even Tormis, at this late date, enters a new phase with instrumental transcriptions of his choral works that should bring his music to a much wider audience. But the pieces sound nothing like the busy, descriptive overtures he wrote before his choral conversion. By no means is the singing revolution forgotten. It runs underneath everything like subterranean spring water. Some Baltic orchestra conductors are so vocally accomplished they could fill in for an indisposed opera singer. No matter what direction new compositions go, even in the gargantuan symphonic canvases of Erkki Sventtur, this music is anchored in the human voice. Maybe Baltic composers are able to fly so high because their roots are so simple, deep, and found everywhere around them.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.